This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power, and welcome to The Q Interview from CBC Podcasts and from Q on CBC Radio 1. So nice to be back after a month off. I was so glad my postcards got in. Caitlin Swan, who was guest hosting the show over the past month, the pride and joy of Regina, Saskatchewan, is with me right now. Caitlin, what else did you say? I was getting all these notes from people saying that what I was up to while I was off. What else did you say I was up to?
The skipping rocks.
Okay.
Down at the swimming hole, which yeah. I like to imagine you were doing, like, you know, on a rope, you know, doing cannonballs with the sun streaming through the trees.
I definitely skipped a rock.
Did you?
Yeah, I definitely skipped a rock, but I did not do any cannonballs. No.
Well, let me ask you this: was there any appearance of a piña colada over the holiday?
No, I had a mimosa.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
That's pretty close to a piña colada.
And I went to a tiki bar.
Okay, that's really close. Oh, that's great then. So yeah. What I said wasn't totally rubbish.
No, I went to... When did you become a chimney sweep from Victorian England?
I don't know where rubbish... Honestly, I haven't said that word in like 10 years.
Oh, governor, it wasn't completely rubbish that I told you that.
Bullocks?
Excuse me?
I don't know.
Today on the show, and by the way, Caitlin, thanks a lot for sitting in for me the past couple of while. I appreciate that.
You are so welcome.
Terry Crews is on the show today. Terry Crews, who you might know from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He was also, before that, a professional football player. But really, Terry's journey is all about just trying to get away from his hometown as quickly as possible. He could not wait to leave Flint, Michigan. I don't feel that way about St. John's. I don't think you feel that way about Regina, Caitlin.
Just to get away?
Yeah. Couldn't wait to leave?
No, I just wanted to leave.
Oh, you did want to leave. Yeah.
So I relate to Terry here. I just needed to get out. But know what? Leaving has given me a perspective of my homeland in which I just want to go back. So it's kind of done what it needed to do. Give me some distance so I can love it again, you know?
Yeah. And you learned that your hometown is not rubbish.
Exactly.
So Terry Crews, like with what Caitlin mentions there, you know, he has an interesting perspective on his hometown now. But he also has a really interesting definition of what it means to be tough and what it means to be powerful. Terry Crews is such a great talker. He's such a great conversationalist. Any chance I get to talk to him. He was actually – do you know this, Caitlin? He was on the first Q show I ever did in my life.
Yeah, you had mentioned that. That's wild. What a blast from the past.
Yeah, back when I guest hosted the show, way, way back when.
Oh my gosh. I was like, what, 40 years ago?
Yeah, 43 years ago.
Wow. I thought I was close.
Yeah, we had to do cigarette ads in the middle of it, but it was okay.
Different times.
Yeah,
right?
Some say better times, not for all.
I do.
It was Terry Crews, Lowell, and I want to say Sloan, maybe? Anyway. I know things really went downhill. Here is my conversation with the great Terry Crews. How are you?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I'm doing good.
I'm not too bad. Flint, Michigan, where you grew up, not too far from Canada.
That's right. Like sisters.
Yeah, and it was back in the days where you could go across the border without the passport, too. So there was nothing to it, you know?
Yeah, and Detroit is the only place you could go south in America and end up in Canada. I love that.
Now, reading your book, I realize I don't know that much about Flint, Michigan. So I know, I first heard about Flint, Michigan through the Michael Moore documentary, that Roger and Me, and about the GM layoffs and plant closures in Flint. And then sadly, you know, recently about the water crisis that happened in Flint. So it was interesting to see it through your eyes. Talk to me a little bit about the Flint, Michigan of your youth.
Yes. First of all, when I was young, you know, I am a child of the 70s. I was born in 1968 and spent most of my, you know, the 60s and 70s, or the 70s and 80s in Flint, Michigan. And it was, when I was young, it was like Palo Alto. You know, I try to really express, you know, what it was like. It's trying to bring comparisons to Google. And, you know, General Motors was the number one corporation in the world. So it was making lots of money. American cars were really booming and no one thought it would end. And then around the late 70s, so about 78, 79, there was the gas crisis and then foreign cars started to come into the picture. And I remember as a kid when, you know, there'd be little smokestacks going up around the city. And when you found the source of the smoke, it was, they used to burn foreign cars in the lot. And it was, it's, you can't even imagine it now, but I remember it happened on a regular, and there were a lot of workers who were like, no way, there will be no foreign cars in America. And, you know, if you had one, they'd burn it. It was very dangerous to try to drive a Toyota into Flint, Michigan, because it was a Buick town. It, my dad worked for Buick. My mother was a housewife, but my grandmother worked for AC Spark Plug, and everything in the city revolved around the vehicles. But the auto industry was very quickly shrinking and falling, and the American auto industry went through a terrible, terrible, I don't know what to say. It was just over. Like, it, what they promised everyone was that you were going to have pensions and we're going to take care of you forever. And that promise was quickly revoked. And on top of that, there was the crack epidemic that happened in the early 80s when people discovered cocaine could be made into crack and was sold cheaply. And so a lot of people went straight from the factories to the drug game. And it was a horrible, horrible mix. I just remember being afraid, being scared. And, you know, the city was going through a massive, massive change, and it didn't stop. Like, when I say it started rolling downhill and then just sped up, it just, I mean, there was white flight and then it was black flight. You know, everybody was gone. My high school that I ended up, you know, going to is basically a field right now. All of my memories, when I go back to Flint, Michigan, are gone. Most of the memories, all of the stores I used to go to, the places I used to hang out, this is no longer, the movie theaters I would go to, nothing.
What does that do to you when you go home and the things you remember aren't there?
It's, you know what? It's surreal. It's almost like, it's like visiting a barren planet. You know, you have your memories. You might even remember the street, but what's wild is all the homes. You know, only thing I can compare it to is like when you go to your elementary school.
Yeah.
And you see, and you feel like a giant. You're like, wow, it was so big when you were little, you know. When I go back to Flint, it's much smaller. All the streets are smaller, but then my memories are gone. Like, I said, that was my friend's house, but it's not there. So it feels like someone came and stole your memories, like stole everything that you remember. So you have to piece everything together. It's just frightening. And then the water crisis. So, you know, you're talking about tragedy after tragedy.
And that's outside your home. But also, I mean, you write pretty honestly in this book that it was also challenging inside your home and the complicated relationship you had with your folks. Can you tell me a little bit about them?
Yeah. And that was another thing. It's like stacked on top of all of that was the problems in my house. My father was an alcoholic. And he was an alcoholic in the days where you didn't really define, no one really knew what being an alcoholic was. You were just kind of, you know, if you were homeless, you were called a wino.
Yeah.
You know, but no one, everyone just drank.
They were drinkers.
Yeah, there was no such thing as alcoholism.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just like, if you had a job, you're fine, you know. But my father was a severe alcoholic and, you know, he abused my mother. I mean, my earliest memory is him knocking my mom out. And, but my mother, she, in response to his alcoholism, she escaped into religion. And we were in this church that was extremely restrictive. I mean, I couldn't go to the movies. I couldn't go, I couldn't dance. I couldn't listen to secular music. I couldn't play sports. And what's wild is everything I ended up doing with my life, I could not do as a young kid. Now that did change as I got into, you know, around 13, 14 years old. But anything before 14 was was off limits.
So let's start there. So you have that life outside the house. You have that life inside the house. Let's talk about the first definition of tough. Like, what was tough then for you? What did tough mean to you back then?
Tough meant, again, watching my father rule his house with impunity. I mean, it was something that, you know, it was all about going to work, and he would rather be feared than loved. That's was the big thing. And I thought that was the definition of toughness. It was, you know, it was his way or the highway. And if you didn't like it, it was, you might get his wrath. And one thing I never wanted to do was face my father's wrath because I was scared of him. I was totally afraid of him. I felt totally powerless, and he was the tough guy, and he had the ability to inflict pain. And my mother would kind of try to stand up to him, and he'd punch her and, you know, manhandle her. And thank goodness he never did that to us, because we just did whatever he said. You know, it was, we were like, no mas, it was no problem, whatever you want. But the definition of tough back then was the ability to rule with impunity. And I mean, through violence, if necessary. You know, it was bad.
When does art start to come into your life? Like, when do you start to realize that, like, wow, I like art, I like artistic things? When does that first start to come to you?
You know, because my mom was so religious, you know, I had a crazy imagination. And I used to go to school and hear kids talking about movies. Now, we were able to watch TV. And so I was always seeing trailers for movies and different things. And I would hear kids talk about movies they saw, and I would go home and I would draw them. Like, I would draw what I thought the movie was, you know? It was
like,
really
like they would talk about what the movie, and you'd be like, okay, I got an idea what this might be, you know? Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
this is what this Han Solo guy might look like. Sure, you know?
It was so bizarre, because I remember them talking about all kind of movies and different stuff. And I remember just trying to draw it. And, you know, and this is back in the day where a movie would be in the theater for 2 years. You know, it was, you know, it's so wild when you think about the way the world is now as opposed to back then. They would four wall a movie and it would be there for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then you had no hope of ever seeing it on television. You know what I mean? But what was so wild is my imagination was really, really active. And I would draw these things. And you know, another thing, I escaped into comic books, lots and lots of comic books. Anytime I had a chance to get any comic book, I was all over it. I would copy it. I would try to make the muscles work just like that. And I always had a desire to be strong. Because I thought one day I may have to kill my dad. Like, I know this because it was the powerlessness that drove me into feeling strong. I needed to protect my family, protect my mom. And one day I may have to go up against him. And that was a reality.
I think that, I mean, A, that's so powerful. And so it's still so sad to hear you say that, you know, because I think up until that moment, in this interview, people can think who don't know you too well that this is the path. You know, you have a hard upbringing in Flint. You discover art. You become an artist. You become the Terry Crews we know and love. But people who know you a little bit better will know that you actually started out in professional football. You started out in college ball and then in the NFL. And in your book, you write, "Football wasn't my dream. Art was." So this is what I'm curious about. Why not go the artistic route first?
Well, I had no examples of anybody being successful in art. I didn't know how, I didn't think anyone was ever going to pay me for art. I just, you know, the term starving artist is what I heard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I had no interest in starving. You know what I mean? I had an image of a guy who made no money at all, scraping by, doing what he had to do, you know, painting wonderful paintings for nothing. That was the image. And I was like, that can't be me, because I want more than this. Like, you know, we grew up in a house, you know, our first home had rats and roaches, and we moved up to a better house a little around third grade. But I had more sights on more because I started to see more, and I did not see how art was going to do it. It to me, art seemed like charity. It was like a fun pastime, and it wasn't valued in my community. I don't remember any artist being treated like, wow, he's amazing and extolled. You know what I mean?
But football was yeah. Something. Yeah.
Absolutely. The athletics was everything. And Flint, Michigan had its share of really great athletes. And, you know, it was one of those things that it was totally valued. And I knew it was going to be my way out, because in this desire to be strong, I also figured out, wait a minute, this could be my ticket out of here, because I had to get out. I knew this city is falling fast. And I had determined that sports was going to be my way out, even though I didn't like football that much. I just didn't.
The interesting thing about that is that you're not telling me that I wanted to be an artist, but I didn't see a path to doing that. So I right. became a plumber, or I worked at GM, or I worked in a car company, or I did literally anything. Like, Terry, the chances of being a successful actor and the chances of being a professional NFL player are about the same in terms of how rare they are. Like, as we say back where I'm from, they're about as scarce as hen's teeth, right? Like, you're more likely to win the lottery than to become a professional football player or a successful actor.
Yep.
It takes a tremendous amount of dedication and determination to get those two things. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? You must reflect on that, though. Those two paths are very unlikely.
I'm going to tell you this. Growing up, being a child of an alcoholic dad, it drives you.
Yeah.
There are two ways to actually be motivated into success. And the first way is to be kicked into it. I like to call it be beat into it, where, you know, you are going to live your life like it's a revenge movie. You've been hurt. You've been damaged, and now you're going to get everybody back who ever doubted or insulted you or in some way counted you out. So now that drive is a supreme motivator. I mean, people make movies about this stuff, yeah. You know what I mean? And it's like, wow, like it can really get you going. But the other way is to be inspired into it, to be like, oh my God, I feel moved toward this or whatever. And I was the other way. I was the latter. The first one. It was, I wanted to get revenge. And, you know, you got to understand, growing up in Flint and having art talent, it was looked at as being white, which was another problem where, you know, there were gangs and the drug dealers, and the gangs started to gain prominence and got, especially when the crack era hit and I hit my teens and these guys were making money dealing drugs and all this stuff. You got to understand, being an athlete coded safe. It was like coded hardcore black. And once I got a neck, the gangs would leave me alone. You know, it was kind of like, he's got a career coming. He's got sports, so we're not going to mess with him because he may have a future. You know what I mean? Where other kids were not so lucky. And in a lot of ways, being an athlete protected me. But I had to dumb myself down a lot of times where I would be on my way to school or whatever. And you had to be careful. You weren't seen as talking white, so to speak. And you know, so you really dumb yourself down. It's like, yeah, man, you know what I mean, and blah, blah, blah. And you try to talk like the gang members. Everybody talked like Richard Pryor. It was that cadence and that feel. And I remember just copying people. And be honest with you, that is where a lot of acting ability came from. I mean, it was like I learned how to mimic people a lot because it was. No, I mean, I had a portfolio or bringing my art stuff or whatever. And you didn't want, you know, some gang member or drug dealer to grab your stuff and rip it out of your hands and, you know, dog you out. You know what I mean? It was so crazy. I remember I felt like I had to fight my way into school as opposed to, you know, the other way around. It was so weird.
What's weird about it, and maybe not weird about it, but what's funny about it is that outsiderness follows you from Flint into the NFL. And in the early days of your acting career, you get sort of pigeonholed as a tough guy, and you're playing gang members and you're playing bouncers. Things change when you do this movie. I just want to play a clip.
How did you know? I love this song.
Making my way downtown, walking fast, faces pass and I'm homebound. And I need you. And I miss you.
Terry, can you tell us what we're listening to right now?
Good old 1,000 Miles by Vanessa Carlton.
And you singing it.
I love that song. Love, I still do. You have to understand too, I mean, I always was the class clown,
yeah,
the guy who, you know, at the family reunion would have fun and try to show, you know, do dances and do all this other kind of stuff. Even though my mother didn't allow it, I was always had this imagination and was doing stuff. And she would actually let me do it in the house. Like to kind of entertain the family. I would say, look at what I can do. I can do a robot like this and that. And she'd go, yeah, yeah. And I was like, can I go to the dance? And she'd say, no, you know? And I was like, she wouldn't let me perform in my high school talent show. So I asked her, can I host it? And she said, oh, okay. All right. So I ended up hosting my high school talent show simply because she wouldn't let me perform in it, because it was kind of against her rules. But little did she know, I would end up hosting the biggest talent show in the world, you know, and neither did I. But I was always, always wanting to be out there and very gregarious, because another thing about, you know, when you look at most comedic actors and comedians,
yeah,
they tend to come have hard lives. And it was the way I coped with how sad things were. You know what I mean? Sometimes you have to laugh to keep from crying.
More from Terry Crews in just a minute. Here's the rest of my conversation with Terry Crews.
The Carol Burnett Show was our favorite thing to do. I remember Saturday night, and, you know, again, without... we could watch TV, and it was some of my mom's favorite things. And I used to actually mimic the characters, do skits for her, the whole thing. And she'd be like nursing a black eye that my father gave her.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was one of the things where I saw it was my superpower, because she would still laugh at me and doing these things through all her pain. And I said, this is an ability. Like,
yeah,
I like this ability to make people laugh, even in the most heinous circumstances. And I had the pleasure of meeting Carol Burnett about 3 years ago. And my God, it was surreal, man.
Did you tell her?
I did. I said, you are the reason I am in this business right now. I said, your comedy, everything about your show inspired me forever. This is one reason why I wanted to host a variety show, because it was like the Carol Burnett Show, you know? And she's, you know, a lot of, it's funny because a lot of black comedians are always inspired by Richard Pryor or, you know, Bill Cosby even. But I was always inspired by Carol Burnett and her crew, you know, Harvey Korman, Vicki Lawrence, Tim Conway. That was my crew right there, man. I love those guys. And I would even watch SCTV when I got into my team.
Another Canadian influence there.
Yes, absolutely. SCTV, Eugene Levy and John Candy and Rick Moranis. I mean, dude, I watched that nonstop and dreamed about the day I could be funny for everybody.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I wanted to ask you about this thing you write in your book. You write, once I found my way to acting in comedies, life got exponentially more difficult. To be a black actor in the world of comedy is like tap dancing blindfolded through a minefield. Can you tell me more about that?
Because you have to represent black people at all times. And everyone is concerned about how you're making the race look. And this is a concern that Jim Carrey doesn't have, you know, Ben Stiller doesn't have to worry about that. You know, all these comedic actors can kind of just go be funny and people go, oh, okay, that's you. But when I would be funny, you're kind of representing everything at all at once. And the scary part is that I always had to come to terms with the fact that, you know, we as a culture cared more about how we looked than how we were. Like, and that's very, very important to say, you know. And I developed that attitude of caring more about my image than who I was inside. And it's something that can be very, very dangerous because you're ignoring all the problems. You're ignoring all that stuff. But as long as you represent and have your image right, you could do, people got away with all kinds of stuff. We had crooked preachers. We had crooked politicians. I mean, especially in Flint, with the pastor that I had when I was a kid, I mean, he was honored by the community. He was a big time bishop, but he was selling drugs and using drugs out of the pulpit. And it was like he could get away with it simply because he had the image.
Right.
No one cared about who he really was. I mean, he had girlfriends all over the church and it was foul. But to everyone else, it was just, well, he's got the image, so we're not going to mess with him. And this kind of thing is so, so dangerous. But as a comedic actor, if you get too goofy and if too many white people are laughing, they look at it as like, oh man, you know, you're not representing us well. This is the thing I even understood when Dave Chappelle stepped down. When he stopped doing his Dave Chappelle show, simply because he felt like, okay, the white guys in the place are laughing a little too hard.
Yeah, he said, what did he say? He said that they were on set and he was doing a sketch and the black folks in the room were laughing. And then one of the white folks in the room was laughing in a way that made him feel uncomfortable. It wasn't the laugh he was looking for.
Yep. And he stopped.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the pressure. That was the minefield. You know, Dave Chappelle hit a mine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, boom. And all of a sudden he's like, everybody's like, he walked away from $50 million and all this. And he immediately, you know, just, that's the pressure you feel. And it's wild because it's pressure that no other comedians feel. It's really unique. And what can I say? It's just a reality out there.
I think all of these things that you've talked about so far and are just part of some of the quite compelling vulnerability that you put out in this book. I mean, so this is your second memoir and you go into detail about some terribly hard things in your life that you didn't necessarily cover in the first one. You know, already you've talked to me a little bit about the abuse you suffered as a child, you know, having to get strong. So you knew that one day you would, you know, you thought one day you might have to kill your father. There is a tremendously upsetting and captivating, and I mean upsetting in the most respectful way, you know, scene where you do fight your father in this book. Speaking up after sexual assault, you know, anger issues. Talking about these things takes a lot out of someone.
Man, I was filled with rage. You know, my wife used to tell me, she would say, "You're an angry man." And I would get, wait, she would tell me I was angry and I would get mad. What's so crazy? I would get mad because I'm not angry. Well, what are you talking about? I'm angry. You know, like, and she's like, "You just proved my point." Well, I don't know what to say. And I had all this pent up rage because, you know, what's wild is I have to say in a very, competitive world, I grew up, the competition was fierce and intense. I mean, again, just from the drug dealers and the gang members, because I was being recruited by gangs and this whole thing, and I was trying to do everything I could to not be a part of that stuff. And then the sports world was one of those things where, you know, you had to be the best at all times. And then, you know, but these kind of conditions create a lot of dissatisfaction with your life. Like, you know, if you didn't know someone else had two cars, you'd be just happy with your one car. But the fact is, you're like, oh, I got to keep up with this guy. And that creates pressure. And it creates a thing where you're trying to keep up. And this is the thing. Like, the myths of manhood are you are invincible. And you got to take on the biggest challenge and do the biggest thing. And you got to beat everybody else. And this made me angry all the time.
Yeah.
And I was very duplicitous. I would look at you and smile, but feel like I wanted to destroy you.
Yeah.
And saw everybody as a threat, you know, and that makes you very, very angry. And I could snap at the drop of a hat. I had a temper, even as a kid, and kick everybody off my basketball court. If they didn't pick me. You know, and I'm like, it's my court. So, you know, and nobody wanted to play with me. So I knew I couldn't do that anymore. I had so much rage. And it was a problem, man. I was knocking people out, you know, and this is another thing, too. I want to add to that is that in a world like that, in a supremely competitive world, I was addicted to approval, meaning if everybody liked me, approved of me, wanted me, this is also part of the class clown thing, that it increased my value as a human being.
Yeah.
But if I was disapproved of, I would snap. Yeah. And I mean, any bit of any slight, it would make me want to just go punch you in the face. And at many times I did it. And it was crazy. It was just not healthy.
What is writing this stuff down do for you?
Oh, first of all, you know, there's something about confession, you know, that's past religion. You know what I mean? It's something about seeing it, looking at it, holding it up in the light and seeing who you really, really are. It's so cathartic. And unless you know, this is one thing in the 12 steps, they say is that you have to do a moral inventory. You know, once you have an addiction, you know, you have to do a complete moral inventory, and then you have to tell someone that you love, because that will hold you to an accountability. It's almost like you can see it as it is and not as you think it is. You know what I mean? It's kind of wild, but, you know, I had to really, once I got transparent, it was like, wow, I saw. The perfect example is I had created an image of a fictional Terry Crews that was perfect, that was an amazing guy, that could do anything, that, you know, bullets would bounce off his chest as he popped his pecs. You know what I mean? So it was all good. But this image was false. It was not real. And you hide behind that guy. You know what I mean? Success is the warmest place to hide. Especially in Hollywood or even in sports, where you see, you know, guys that are awesome and doing amazing things sporting wise, but then their personal lives are a mess, you know, but nobody cares.
Yeah.
Because you're so successful in one area. You know, I like to say this too, you know, fake it till you make it works. But when you make it, you're still fake. That's the issue,
yeah.
You know? It's like fake it till you make it. And then you create this dude and everybody loves him, but it's not you. You know what I mean? And that was my problem.
I have two questions, and I know we're running short on time, but I just want to ask these last two.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, I hope you can take it in the spirit that I mean it, which is with a generous spirit and a curiosity about this. Yeah, yeah. I'm curious about gratitude. Because when you have, you said something really powerful earlier, you were talking about, there's two things that can motivate you, you know, like kind of like anger, spite, like I'm going to beat you. You challenged me, you told me I couldn't do it. I'm going to do it. Or inspiration, right? Inspiration,
yes.
Which is lovely. When you are not motivated by inspiration, you're motivated by all these, Terry, I'll be honest with you, like really challenging things,
yeah.
Awful things that kind of no human should have to go through that you went through. And you look around at your house and you look around at your career, you look around your friends and your relationships and you go, look what I've achieved. How do you approach gratitude? And I mean this honestly, like how do you approach gratitude knowing that it comes from such a hard, all those things can come from such a hard time in your life?
Wow. This is where that's a great question, man. I look at it as a chess match. You know, one move didn't win the game. It didn't win the match. You know what I mean? It was a series of moves, a whole lot of moves, some moves that went backward. You know what I mean? But there was, I think it's also a little bit of nature versus nurture, where, you know, some people feel like you're either have it or you don't. You know, you just either you're born with it or not. But I never believed that. I always believed we were works in progress, that you could change who you were. The phrase I like to use is that humanity comes into this world assembly require, you know? And one thing that I looked at is that the setbacks were also they were amazingly powerful in that if you see them the right way, that's the issue. Seeing them the right way, they will help you. The phrase I've heard and used, it got me through the pandemic, is that sometimes your greatest hopes are destroyed to prepare you for something better. And I look at all those negative things as preparation. Have you ever seen someone who was super handsome, super great, super smart, and the world praises them very young? Like, valedictorian is always the hottest thing ever. And then when they grow up, it's like, and years go on, the valedictorian usually lives an okay life. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, people determine winners way too early. You know, you can be an adult prodigy. I truly believe that. Mm-hmm. And I look at this whole thing almost like a rocket ship. You know what I mean? And all the pain and obstacles, you have to use those obstacles as footstools, but that's a choice. That's why once I knew that I had a problem and that I was seeing the world the wrong way, I was responsible to do something about it. And I had to, this is when even at the, against my own teachings, I went to therapy, because growing up, therapy was looked at as quackery. You know, it was, you know, you can't cure crazy. And I said, man, wait a minute, I'm getting this thing wrong. I got to go check this stuff out. And once I did, oh my God. And now this is where the gratitude comes from.
So let me close this way. We know what tough meant when you were a kid in Flint. What does tough mean now?
Tough, when I was younger, meant the ability to throw punches. But now tough is the ability to take them, the obstacles, the endurance, and learning from every obstacle and stepping on it and building from it. That's the true meaning of toughness, actually looking at yourself, doing surgery on yourself, and really coming out better. But it's hard. It's not easy.
Yeah.
Because that personal moral inventory is a doozy. You know what I mean? Like, it could, because you don't know. I have lied to myself so many times, and I had to go back through every one of them and erase them and correct them. And that's one reason why being so transparent is part of that inventory that allows you to say, now I'm here. Like, I went from fictional Terry Crews to the nonfiction Terry Crews.
Well, I'm so glad I got to talk to the nonfiction Terry Crews today.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your time and opening up about all this stuff.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure, man. I always love talking to you.
Terry Crews is an actor. There you have it. I mean, really, you could ask him anything. He'll give you great answers. He is a beautiful and thoughtful man. He's also the host of the show America's Got Talent. His memoir, Tough, My Journey to True Power, is out now. Caitlin, thanks so much for, again, sitting in for me reintroduce you here, the pride and joy of Regina, Saskatchewan, Q interview producer Caitlin Swan. Thanks for sitting in for me. Did you have fun on the show the past month?
Oh, Tom, it was my pleasure. And yeah, I had loads of fun. It was fun sitting in the host chair, you know, where they feed you grapes and fan you with palm leaves. That was good. I got the Royal Tom treatment.
It gets a little chilly with the palm leaves, but they're getting better at it all the time, aren't they?
Oh, truly. They're actually on their A game. You know, they have there's slow, there's medium, there's fast. They can do it all.
Yeah, but the grapes are not in season. It's a bad scene. But you know, sometimes I don't even want grapes. But you know, when people got to work. This is our last episode of the Q Interview Podcast. The reason which you will learn very, very soon. I am not going anywhere. Caitlin's not going anywhere. But we have some pretty exciting news to talk to you about sometime in the future. But thanks so much for listening. You can always listen to the show on the regular Q feed. And again, we're going to have some pretty cool news about all that happening very soon. And thank you, Caitlin. Like, this has been such a joy to do this show with you over the past year or so. I really got a kick out of it.
Aw, thanks, Tom. And likewise, this has been a blast. I'm really excited to let the people know what we got cooking.
It's very, very exciting. You know what? I'll just tell them. Caitlin and I are going to go work at the Keg.
Yeah, you know, I really love those garlic mashed potatoes. I couldn't live without them. So, you know, I do what you love and you never work a day in your life. So I'm going to the Keg.
We'll see you there. When you're there, your family. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Q Interview. I'm on Instagram at Tom Joe Power. The show is there at CBCQ. We'll talk to you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.